Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and welcome to the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. This is a space for down-to-earth, honest conversations about what's really going on in your body in your 40s and how to support yourself through it. If you're feeling a bit out of sync, overwhelmed, or just not quite like yourself, you're in the right place. So let's get into today's episode. Hi, and welcome back to another episode. Another week. Last week, we talked about why weight gain during perimenopause isn't just about calories. So if you listen to that episode, this was a great follow-on episode. You can listen to this one as a standalone, but I promise that I'd go into more detail on this subject today because it all ties in together. We explored how your metabolism, your muscles, your hormones, your nervous system, and your sleep all work together to influence the way your body uses and stores energy. And right at the end of the episode, I said this was the topic that deserves an episode all of its own. Because when it comes to blood sugar, I think blood sugar has a bit of an image problem, let's say. So for a lot of people, the moment they hear the words blood sugar, they tend to think that's something I only need to worry about if I have diabetes. But nothing could be further from the truth. Whether you have diabetes or not, or pre-diabetes, or you're worried about diabetes, your blood sugar is influencing how you feel every single day, completely aside from that. It affects your energy, your concentration, your mood, your cravings, your appetite, your sleep, your hormones, including things like PMS, your experience as you move through perimenopause, your ability to build muscle. And yeah, it even influences how easily your body stores and burns energy. So of course, that is tied in with weight management. So today's episode isn't about diabetes. It's about understanding one of the most important systems in the body. And it's why it's such a foundational piece in, for example, all the work that I do, whether one-to-one, group work, as part of my Midlife Thrive course and membership. It is one of the most foundational pieces that we do want to address. And with most of my clients, it's where we're going pretty much first. Once you understand how your body regulates blood sugar, a lot of things suddenly they kind of make more sense in terms of symptoms. You know, for example, you might have noticed that you're absolutely ravenous every day by around 3 o'clock and just absolutely craving something sweet or carbohydrate based, or that you feel sleepy after lunch or after meals. After lunch is a common one. Maybe you've started craving chocolate in the evening in a way that you never used to, or other sweet things. Maybe you're waking during the night feeling wide awake around 2 or 3 a.m. Maybe you're finding your energy is just all over the place. You can't go for too long between each meal. You sort of need to eat every kind of hour or two. You're feeling sort of hangry. You're a mixture of hungry and angry before, you know, when you get hungry, but when you know you need to eat. And these kind of symptoms, experiences, they can have a lot of different causes, of course. And we would need to look at those too, those possibilities. But unstable blood sugar is one piece of the puzzle that's usually overlooked. And like I say, it's the most foundational piece. And if we don't look there first, we risk not finding it, obviously, and also not finding something that's quite simple to work with, to address. And the results, you know, in terms of symptoms and experiences are, you know, can be significant when we look at addressing blood sugar. So the really encouraging thing is that it's also one of the areas where our daily habits can make a meaningful difference, like simple daily habits. So today I want to explain what's happening inside your body in a way that feels simple and practical and just helps you to understand this without the need for any complicated science explanations or lessons or, you know, fear. So just to give you a better understanding of why your body behaves the way that it does, because as you've probably gathered by now, if you've been listening to the series that I've been doing since I think it was episode 92 or 93, understanding our physiology just changes everything. Once we have that knowledge and understanding about what's going on, it allows us to stop blaming ourselves and to start supporting our bodies instead. So let's start with the basics. Blood sugar, or blood glucose, is the same thing. Glucose is sugar. Sugar is glucose. Simply refers to the amount of sugar, glucose, that's circulating in your bloodstream at any one time. Glucose is one of the body's main sources of energy that the preferred source of energy, and every single cell in your body and your brain relies on it for energy to function. Your brain relies on it. So clarity, memory, you know, your ability to think quickly and feel good as well. Your muscles rely on it. Your immune system relies on it. Your heart relies on it. Quite simply, without glucose, we couldn't function. So where does glucose come from? Mostly it comes from the foods that we eat. So when it's predominantly carbohydrates. So whenever we eat carbohydrates in any form, whether that's oats, potatoes, rice, fruit, beans, lentils, bread, a biscuit, a pastry, a wrap, our digestive system breaks those carbohydrates down into glucose. That glucose is then absorbed into the bloodstream. And that's where something really clever happens. Our bodies are amazing. Your body doesn't just simply allow your blood sugar to just rise unchecked. So again, we use the term blood sugar, but what we're talking about is the level of sugar or glucose in the blood. And your body's very clever. It won't just, you know, once you eat carbohydrates, they get broken down into sugar and that goes into the bloodstream. It can't just allow that blood sugar to just be rising and rising. It is constantly monitoring it. We have a system in our body that is so cleverly and closely monitoring every minute of every day how much sugar, glucose we have in our bloodstream at any one time. And it's always making tiny little adjustments to keep your blood sugar fluctuating or remaining within a healthy range. So it will fluctuate throughout the day, but there's a range for which it should be fluctuating within. And that's because your body likes balance. It needs balance. So too much glucose circulating in the bloodstream isn't good for our health, but equally too little isn't healthy either. So we don't want high blood sugar and we don't want low blood sugar. Your brain in particular depends on a steady supply of glucose to function well. So your body works really hard to keep these things nicely balanced. And in fact, here's something that completely changed the way I think about blood sugar when I first learned it in college many years ago. At any one moment, there's only around 1 teaspoon of glucose circulating in your bloodstream, just 1 teaspoon. So picture a teaspoon of white sugar. Right? That is at any one time how much glucose is circulating, should be circulating in the bloodstream. And when you think about everything your body's doing every second of every day, all the energy it's producing, all the decisions it's making, all the cells it's fueling, it manages to keep the amount of glucose in your bloodstream within quite a remarkably narrow range. And to me, that's just a really wonderful reminder of how intelligent our human body really is. And it's constantly working behind the scenes to keep everything in balance, not working against us. It's not trying to work against us. Although we, as we move through perimenopause, especially, we might really feel like it is, or it's just suddenly started to, but it really isn't. I hope, you know, I talked about that in previous episodes as well last week. It's always trying to keep everything in balance. And when we understand that, we stop seeing blood sugar as something that is only relevant if you're, you know, pre-diabetic or worried about diabetes or you are diabetic. We can start to appreciate it for what it really is, which is one of the foundations of good health. So how does your body keep blood sugar in that healthy range, that tight, healthy range? This is where we meet one of the body's most important hormones, and that's insulin. Now, insulin gets given a bad reputation online. People talk about spiking insulin, you know, we shouldn't be doing this because it's going to spike insulin, as though insulin itself is the problem. It's not insulin that's the problem. Insulin is not the enemy. Far from it. It's a really important survival hormone. Without insulin, we couldn't survive. So I like to think of insulin as a messenger. It's a hormone released by the pancreas. And so, for example, imagine that you've just eaten your lunch and there's these, you know, the carbohydrate element of your food that gets digested. This also applies to partially to protein, but mostly carbohydrates. So as the carbohydrate element of your meal is broken down, glucose starts to enter your bloodstream. And then your pancreas senses this rise in blood sugar. And as a result of that, it releases insulin into the blood sugar, into the bloodstream. And insulin's job is essentially to knock on the doors of your cells and say, hi, good news, guys, there's some energy available. Let's bring it inside where it can be used. So then the cells in your muscles open the door
They've got these little, it's called receptors, cell receptors. They're like a little doorway on the cell. Your liver cells open the doors and other cells around the body open their doors as well. And then that glucose leaves the bloodstream, enters in through the doors of those cells into the cells, where it can either be used straight away for energy or it gets stored for energy to be used later when we need to tap into it. So it's a really beautifully designed system. It's simple, it's elegant, and it's efficient. At least that's when everything's working well. But because during perimenopause, one of the changes we can start to see as we move into our 40s is that those doors, they start to respond less well, less efficiently to insulin's knock compared to, you know, 20s and 30s. And that's where I'd like to sort of take us today, is really understanding what that change actually is and what that can mean for us. And then what we can do to support it. So we've talked about insulin acting as your body's messenger hormone. So it delivers the message that glucose is available and encourages your cells to let that glucose in. So it can be used for energy or stored for later. When that system is working well, we describe that as having good insulin sensitivity or insulin sensitive cells. And in simple terms, that means your cells are listening. They are, when insulin knocks on the door, they're opening their door and allowing the glucose to move easily from your bloodstream inside the cell, where it can then fuel everything from your brain to your muscles. And again, that's an incredibly efficient system. But as we move through perimenopause, that system begins to change. One of the effects of fluctuating and gradually declining estrogen is that our cells can become a little less responsive to insulin than they once were. So we know, you know, estrogen is important for so many different things, and progesterone. We know, you know, the importance, for example, of bone health and heart health and brain health when it comes to estrogen. But I don't think it's talked about enough, its effect on keeping our cells sensitive to insulin. So as it starts to fluctuate erratically, eventually it declines as well. And then it declines even further. And then we reach menopause and we're not making any anymore. That really can, for most people, start to impact their cells' responsiveness to insulin. And the opposite of insulin sensitivity is what's known as insulin resistance. But I do want to reassure you here, it doesn't mean that everyone develops insulin resistance. It certainly doesn't mean you're on a path towards diabetes. Think of it more like turning the volume down on the conversation between insulin and your cells. So before estrogen started to change, it may have been far more efficient for your cells to listen to the action of insulin and be responsive and take it in. And now, as things are changing with estrogen in perimenopause, that the volume's being turned down on that a little bit, that communication isn't as robust. The message is still being sent. Insulin is still asking the cells to open their door and take in, you know, insulin's still coming, pancreas is still sending it. It's just that the cells, the receptors, the doors on those cells are just not hearing it quite as clearly as they should. And as a result of that, your pancreas might need to produce a little more insulin to achieve the same effect, to knock even harder, basically. Okay, the insulin I've sent into the bloodstream has knocked and it's not getting an answer, so I'll send a bit more and it can knock even louder this time. And hopefully we do get an answer, and so on. And over time, that can influence the way your body regulates energy, appetite, and body weight, particularly when it comes to midsection fat gain. Now, once again, we're seeing another example of the whole body shift that we've been talking about throughout this series of episodes from around episode 93. Your body isn't failing. It's not failing on you now that we're in our 40s and getting older. It's adapting. And understanding that can change everything in terms of how understanding sort of how we feel and having more compassion for how we feel. And instead of feeling as though your body suddenly started to work against you and make you feel all these horrible things and experience maybe weight gain that you don't want to experience, you can start to see that it's simply responding to a changing hormonal environment. So you might be wondering, okay, that's interesting what you're telling me and I understand it, but what does it actually mean for how I feel? So this is where things become more relatable. So when our cells aren't responding quite as efficiently to insulin, so they're ignoring the knock on the door, glucose can start to spend a little longer circulating in the bloodstream. It hangs around for longer than it should before it's moved into the cells where it's needed. And remember, your cells rely on glucose for energy, cells in the body, cells in the brain, muscles. And so if they're not receiving that fuel as energy, that glucose as energy, it's hardly surprising that you might begin noticing changes in how you feel. Your energy might become less steady. You might feel great after breakfast, but by 11 o'clock, you're already reaching for another coffee or a biscuit. Maybe lunch leaves you feeling sleepy rather than energized. Maybe you notice that by mid-afternoon, you're just desperately searching the cupboards for something sweet. So if any of this sounds familiar, these experiences aren't necessarily a sign that you've got no self-control, no willpower. You know, I hear this all the time. We've always heard this, haven't we? We've always said it to ourselves. Why can't I just have willpower to not eat the biscuit or not have that mid-morning snack when I promised myself I wouldn't? And it's not about that. It's not about self-control, willpower. It's not even proof that sugar is addictive somehow. More often than not, they're your body's way of asking for more stable energy and letting you know that perhaps now we're in a phase of life where insulin sensitivity isn't as good anymore. The cells are not responding as well to glucose as they were before, now that we're in perimenopause, and we might need to do some, you know, put some things in place to support that. Then we can start to respond with that curiosity rather than anger, you know, the frustration of why is this happening? Why am I feeling like this? And, you know, punishing ourselves and trying to just restrict. So one way I like to think about blood sugar is as a roller coaster. So imagine you start the day with breakfast that's mostly refined carbohydrates. So let's picture a breakfast of a sugary cereal. So think of any sort of sugary cereal, like a crunchy nut cornflakes, or even just cornflakes themselves, or bran flakes even, or a pastry, or just some toast on its own, or some toast and jam. Now, there's absolutely nothing wrong with enjoying these foods from time to time, but this isn't about, you know, I'm not trying to label any foods as good or bad. It's just about understanding what happens next. So let's say you have one of these types of foods at breakfast. It's the first meal that you've eaten since yesterday, since last night. It's your breaking your fast meal. And what happens is, because it's a sugary or, you know, refined carbohydrate meal, there's nothing else balanced with it, no protein, for example. So these foods are digested relatively quickly, these simple sugars. The glucose enters the bloodstream quite quickly. Your pancreas responds by releasing insulin, as it should. Blood sugar then falls again, because insulin has now moved that glucose into the cells. The cells have opened their doors, let it in, and then blood sugar drops down again. For some people, particularly if that meal contains, as we just described, very little protein or fiber, that fall is more likely to be dramatic. So it thought that the rise and fall will be outside of the ideal fluctuation range. That's often when the cravings begin, where you notice that you have unstable energy throughout the day. You suddenly fancy something sweet and you cannot control that craving, or you need another coffee to pick yourself up mid-morning, or a biscuit. Not because you're somehow failing and you're not doing this, you know, you've got no willpower, but because your body is trying to restore its energy supply. Literally, physiologically, that's what's happening. The blood sugar has dropped dramatically too low, below that fluctuation range, outside of the fluctuation range. And genuinely, as a survival mechanism, your body is asking, looking for more energy, e.g. glucose, to come back in and bring that blood sugar level back up. So it's a very clever mechanism. So then obviously that's interpreted as, I need something sweet. So you have something sweet, you satisfy that craving, your blood sugar then rises again. Another insulin response follows. It's likely that the blood sugar has risen high above the fluctuation, the high end of the fluctuation zone, because you've likely had some sugar, you know, something like a biscuit or a muffin, as opposed to something like a protein snack. So then your blood sugar has risen again, likely above the range. You get another insulin response, again, as the body should. But then you get another dip. And before you know it, you've spent the entire day riding what I call the blood sugar roller coaster, which is exhausting physiologically. Mentally, that's a very exhausting roller coaster ride. And by the time you get to the afternoon, the evening, you're wrecked. And you think, why am I so wrecked? I've just been sat at my desk all day and I've just gone to work, or I've just done my work. Well, that's why, because physiologically, you've actually ridden this roller coaster all day and it's exhausting. Now, compare all that with a breakfast that contains plenty of protein, some healthy fats, fiber-rich carbohydrates. So these would be known as complex as opposed to simple carbohydrates that break down much slower into glucose because they have that fiber component as well. And maybe some fruit, like some berries, which is usually a nice kind of slower release form of food, fruit. Now, with this balance to breakfast, instead of a sharp rise in blood glucose, you tend to get a gentler climb, a slower climb that would usually not go further above the ideal, the higher end of the ideal fluctuation range. It stays within it. And then instead of a sudden drop the other way, you enjoy a steadier energy and a steadier, slower drop, maybe over a few hours until, and then that, then your body should sort of start to tell you that it's time to eat again, but more in a steadier way. So you'd enjoy steadier concentration, steadier energy, far fewer cravings, if any. I didn't say it's going to be perfect, because it's not necessarily going to be perfect. You may still have, you know, after 2.5 to 3 hours, oh, I could really fancy something sweet, but it wouldn't be like it's, you know, ravaging you as much as if you had had a sugary or high sort of refined carb breakfast. But we're not looking for things to be perfect. We're just looking to balance things out, for things to be more balanced and more supported. And what will happen is then when you're ready for your next meal, your body is hungry, but it's not, again, screaming out for the biggest high carb lunch because you've, you know, your blood sugar is so low that you are physiologically craving and crying out for the carbs and the sugar. You're now just noticing that you're hungry. And it's, you know, you look at the time and think, oh yeah, haven't, you know, breakfast was 3 or 3.5 hours ago or so. So yeah, let me just go and get my lunch. So, you know, we're not looking to be perfect. Life includes, of course, things like birthdays, holidays, meals out, treats in the office or whatever it might be, and the occasional croissant on a Sunday morning. And those things are absolutely fine. What we're aiming for, though, is consistency rather than being perfect. You know, helping our body spend more of its time on the gentle hills rather than that dramatic blood sugar roller coaster in that healthy fluctuation zone. That's what those gentle hills are. So for most of the time, think about the sort of 80-20 rule. And the more that we support our body to remain, for our blood sugar to remain in that healthy fluctuation range, the more likely it is as well that when we do, say, for example, have a croissant for breakfast on a Sunday morning, take ourselves out for a coffee before breakfast and end up just going for the croissant, rather than being stressed about that and saying, oh no, I must have protein first, we're likely to be able to do those things without the dramatic roller coaster ensuing if we're, for the most part, supporting that, you know, the gentle fluctuation in within the healthy range. It's far less likely to be as impactful when we do have a kind of croissant for breakfast, just as an example. So here's where this starts connecting quite beautifully with everything that we've talked about over the last few weeks. So remember when we spoke about muscle in the previous episode, when we were talking about weight gain, why it can become more likely as we move into perimenopause, not inevitable, but more likely. We talked a lot about the role of muscle there. And one of the reasons muscle is so important is because it's one of the biggest users of glucose in the body. So remember, I talked about this last week, if you listened to that. I talked about healthy muscle being incredibly good at soaking up glucose from the bloodstream. I always picture like the yellow washing up sponge when I think of muscle, and the water going into that sponge being glucose from the bloodstream. So that's soaking up the glucose that's detected as a result of breaking down of your carbohydrate foods. And muscle, the more muscle we have, the more of that glucose is going to get soaked up. So it's almost like having a larger fuel tank, basically, for the foods that we're going to eat. And so essentially the more healthy muscle mass we have, the better equipped our body is going to be at handling the glucose that comes from our meals. And that is wonderful. That's what we want. We want to be able to enjoy our meals. We don't want to restrict. We want to be able to, you know, obviously eat carbohydrates within reason and preferably the fiber rich ones because of the health benefits of those. But we want to be able to happily just eat 3 good meals every day and leave room for some things that we fancy here and there. I talk about the 80-20 rule, where for 80% of the time we're not, you know, having a muffin or something mid-morning or a croissant in the afternoon, but sometimes we do, and that's absolutely okay, because the more muscle mass we have, the more equipped our body will be to handle the breakdown of all of those meals. And we don't have to spend our lives thinking about dieting, restricting, you know, just not being able to eat the foods we love, basically. And that's another reason why strength training isn't simply about building stronger muscles. It's also about supporting healthier metabolism, healthier blood sugar regulation, insulin sensitivity, all foundational for health, and then ultimately healthier aging as a result of those things. So can you see how these pieces are beginning to fit together? So last week we talked about muscle. Today we're talking about blood sugar. Next week we're actually going to talk about another piece of the puzzle. We're going to go more into muscle next week. But these aren't separate conversations. They're all describing the same beautifully interconnected body. And what's great as well is that the same set of nutrition and lifestyle habits or tweaks impact all of it, because it's all interconnected. So if blood sugar regulation matters so much, which it does, how do we actually support it? And again, the things that we can do to support blood sugar will also support all of those other systems as well that we talk about, as everything's connected. So I want to say something first, though, that I think is really important. I don't want this episode to leave you feeling like you just need to monitor every bite of food that you eat. You need to start worrying about your carbohydrates or taking them out, or, you know, just, yeah, becoming obsessed with how many you're having, weighing, tracking, or striving for perfectly flat blood sugar levels every single day, because that's not real life and it's not necessary. Our blood sugar is supposed to rise, as I said, after we eat. It does fluctuate throughout the day. It's completely normal that it rises after we eat, and it should. We should see a spike. But we just want it, you know, if we didn't see a spike, we'd have a problem. It's normal physiology that we do. So the goal isn't to stop blood sugar rising. It's just to help our body manage those rises well, and for those rises and falls to remain within the healthy fluctuation area zone. Your body's designed to do this. We're simply trying to support a system that's now going to be working a little bit harder than it used to, because it's just not as easy or efficient for your cells to stay sensitive to insulin as we move through perimenopause and beyond it. And the lovely thing is that a lot of the habits that support blood sugar, as I said, are exactly the same habits that support our hormones, our muscles, our sleep, our long-term health, our nervous system and stress response. Everything keeps coming back to those same foundations. Even, you know, for someone who's worried about chronic inflammation or immune health, like all of these habits will support all of those things, which is what's really, really helpful. So one of the biggest shifts I'd encourage you to make is to stop thinking about individual foods, just carbohydrates or just this, just that, and start thinking about meals, building meals, you know, that support blood sugar, good blood sugar regulation, appetite, all the nutrients that we need from those meals. For years, we've been taught to focus on what to avoid. Don't eat this, cut out that, reduce this, go on this diet, go on that diet, go on that diet. You know, there's all these different diets that cut out various food groups or types of foods. But a much more helpful question is, what can I add to make this meal more balanced? And I've always worked like this in my practice with clients for the last 14 years that I've been qualified. I have always talked to my clients about, they give me a snapshot of their food intake. So they complete a 3-day food diary, which is really completely a snapshot. I usually ask for 2 working days and a day off, just to give me an idea of how they currently eat. And rather than say, oh, you shouldn't be having that, you shouldn't be having that, it's never about that. It's about what can they be putting in to this meal to make it more balanced, more well-rounded, more substantial. And when we look at it through that lens, instead of what should I be taking out and cutting out, we can start to enjoy things better. You know, we can start to actually feel better because we're actually eating now balanced meals. And then we're looking at it from a lens of nourishing our body, nourishing, giving it what it needs, and allowing, helping, supporting blood sugar to be balanced. Because blood sugar isn't just influenced by our carbohydrate on the plate, how much carbs we eat, how much sugar we eat. It's influenced by what comes with those foods. So let's imagine that you're having a bowl of porridge for breakfast. So rather than thinking, I shouldn't be eating oats then because they're carbs, perhaps we ask, how can I build these oats into a meal that gives me steadier energy? So yeah, a bowl of oats on its own, even though oats are healthy, healthful fibrous carbohydrates, just a bowl of oats by itself may, for some people, spike their blood sugar levels too high, because there is nothing there to buffer that breakdown of glucose from those carbohydrates. So Could you add some Greek yogurt? So what you're really looking for here to buffer that is protein. Protein is the number one nutrient that helps to buffer how quickly glucose is released into the bloodstream. That's what helps keep blood sugar levels in the ideal fluctuation range and support insulin sensitivity. So could you add some full fat Greek yogurt into those oats, because there you're going to be adding some fats and some protein. Fats will also help to buffer the release of glucose as well. It's just that protein is more powerful at it. Could it be that you add a scoop of protein powder from now on? And you may add some chopped nuts or seeds. I would say adding some chopped nuts or seeds is great, but potentially adding some protein powder or some silken tofu. So silken tofu is obviously a form of tofu. You've got firm tofu, but then you've got silken tofu, which you can almost like whisk like an egg. So I like to put that into things. I'll put it into scrambled eggs, put it into omelets, frittatas, put it into smoothies, put it into your oats, because it just mixes in, it just blends in. So that could be some protein as well. Could you add a handful of berries? Now, all of a sudden, you've increased the protein and you've put some good fats in there and you've increased the fiber. And all of those things help to slow the digestion and absorption of the carbohydrate from the oats. And the result there is that you have steadier release of glucose into the bloodstream from the same breakfast that you've now just tweaked. You then have steadier energy across the morning. You'll usually feel satisfied for longer, fuller for longer. And it's not about making food complicated, overhauling everything. It's usually just about making small tweaks to the meals that you already have, and then they'll support insulin sensitivity much better. Now, if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, you'll know that I mention protein a lot. I talk about it probably every episode. And I sometimes worry that people think I'm obsessed with protein. But honestly, I talk about it because it supports so many of the things that we've been discussing throughout this series. Protein helps us preserve and build muscle. It supports healthy aging. It helps us feel fuller for longer. And it slows the rate that glucose enters the bloodstream when it's eaten as part of a balanced meal. So in other words, protein isn't just about muscles. It's very important for helping us to build muscle, but it's about helping us feel more energized, more satisfied, more resilient throughout the day. Resilience is a huge one. I've been having a protein-rich breakfast every morning for years now, maybe 15 or more years. And there's probably just been a handful of times where I've not. The way that I was before I started having protein-rich breakfast, I just don't want to go back to feeling like that. There was one time I accidentally had a very low protein breakfast and I just felt so hungry and exhausted. It's just a non-negotiable for me that I have protein at breakfast. Because it just really helps me feel more resilient and more energized and more stable. And every single client, I've not had one client over the years that I've been working in clinic who has said that increasing protein at their breakfast hasn't impacted them positively. Not one. They will all say the same thing. Wow, I can't believe how different I feel just by having more protein at breakfast, or some protein at breakfast because they weren't having any, or doubling the amount they were having because they didn't realize it wasn't enough. Not one of them has ever said that they didn't benefit from it. And the knock-on impact is huge. It's sleep, it's mood, it's weight issues, if there is one, that just sort of naturally regulate themselves. And you think, wow, like this is all I needed to do. You know, it's usually not the only thing, but it's definitely the first place to start if you're not already doing it. So that's definitely something I am very passionate about. And I won't stop talking about that. And it doesn't mean that every meal has to be perfect. It's just asking yourself, where's the protein? And sort of building every meal around protein. Again, it doesn't have to be obsessive. It doesn't have to be perfect. It's just what, you know, when you think about what you're going to have for lunch and dinner, breakfast throughout the week, if you're planning ahead, like even if you're just sort of thinking in your head, what should we eat on Tuesday? Or what am I going to, I have to bring a packed lunch to work tomorrow. What should I bring? Build it around the protein first. First of all, think, what's the protein? Is it fish? Is it meat? Is it eggs? Is it beans? Is it lentils? Is it tofu? Whatever it might be. Is it a mixture of a few different proteins together? And then write, what sort of veg am I having? Or is it salad? What sort of carbs am I having? Is it rice? Is it potatoes? And then put some healthy fats in there as well. Is it going to be some olive oil, some avocados, some olives, some oily fish, and so on? So just starting the thought process always with the protein, whatever works for you, you know. However, I would always be trying to get around 30 grams as a minimum of protein per meal. So if, for example, you're going to use lentils, then you just need to be mindful that, you know, if you're going to have a whole chicken breast, for example, you're likely to get roughly anywhere between 25 and 30 grams of protein from it. Whereas if you're including lentils, you might only be getting 9-10 grams per sort of portion. So maybe you'll add in some tofu as well. That could be another 9 or 10 grams. And then maybe you'll add in some fish or some cheese as well, just to kind of bump it up. You know, so it can be a mixture of lots of different proteins if that's what you want, whatever works for you. But these small shifts made consistently are so much more powerful than dramatic changes that only last a week. You know, following a program or some sort of plan that you're only going to do for a week or a month, and then what afterwards? So these small shifts can start to become part of your behavior now going forward. And it might take trial and error. You might take some steps forward and then some steps back and then some steps forward and then one back and so on until eventually it is second nature for you to eat 30 grams of protein with every meal and not skip breakfast and always have your protein with your breakfast. It doesn't have to happen overnight because you're going to make these changes forever. Now, there is a very quiet unsung hero in fiber that deserves a little bit more recognition. I have done a separate episode on fiber, not one of my most listened to episodes, probably slightly boring title when we're thinking, oh, fiber. I think we all, you know, we have a rough idea where to find fiber and that we should be eating more of it. But it really is an unsung hero. Fiber is obviously found in foods like vegetables, fruits, berries, beans, lentils, nuts. Maybe you didn't know that in the nuts. So the kind of skin, the outer layer of nuts and seeds has got fiber. And of course, whole grain, whole food sort of carbohydrates like brown rice, quinoa, buckwheat. And unlike other parts of our food, fiber isn't fully digested. So instead, it slows the movement of food through our digestive system. And that means that glucose enters the bloodstream more gradually when we're eating carbohydrates with fiber. And that's not all of it. Fiber also feeds the trillions of microbes that live in our gut. Fiber is a wonderful food to feed the friendly, beneficial, protective bacteria that we've got living in our gut microbiome. They love feeding off the sort of breakdown products of the fiber that we eat. And as we're learning more and more through research, those microbes, they influence so many aspects of our health, from our digestive health to our immunity, inflammation, hormone metabolism, how we break down and clear out our hormones, and even blood sugar regulation. So when I encourage you to eat more colorful vegetables and include beans and lentils a little bit more often, it's never just about one thing. You're supporting multiple systems at the same time. And there is a genuine need and reason to do this, because again, everything is connected. Now, supporting your blood sugar doesn't only happen in the kitchen. So yes, it's really important how we build balanced meals and the types of foods that are on our plate. But it also happens when we move our body, which is wonderful. Something I've been trying to get into the habit of doing. For example, walking after meals, even just 10 minutes has been shown in research to in some studies to support how efficiently your cells soak up insulin just by going for a walk after a meal. So if that's something you can make happen after most meals, you are on to a winner. Let's say at the moment, you know, you eat your meals and just sit down. If that is something you can tweak from now on, where you just do 10 minutes of a gentle walk somehow, just get some steps in, that will make a difference. Just one effective change can really be significant. So remember when we talked about muscle being like a sponge for glucose? Well, every time you use your muscles, you're giving your body another opportunity to use that glucose for energy. So that's one of the reasons that strength training is so beneficial. But it's also why something as simple as, like I just said, as going for a walk after a meal can be at making a big difference. It doesn't have to be a 5-mile hike. You don't have to do this big workout after your meal, and you shouldn't. But yeah, just 10 to 15 minutes of gentle movement, walking around the block, walking around the garden, going out for a walk up and down the stairs, can help your muscles to start using some of the glucose from your meal. And I think that's really wonderful. Says me, who had my lunch an hour ago, promised to follow it with a walk before I sat down to record this. And then I decided to record this before I go for a walk. I shouldn't have done it that way around, but I just wanted to do this first because it's getting quite hot this afternoon. But yeah, you know, it's not about being perfect. So, you know, sometimes we think the answer has to be another intense workout, pushing harder, stop eating this, cut out that, restrict, restrict, restrict. But often it's these small, consistent habits that in the background, quite significantly, without us realizing it, support our physiology every single day until eventually we do realize it, you know, all sort of falls into place. And we think, wow, I'm not doing anything grueling or horrible or restricting. And look at me, I'm feeling more balanced. My weight's falling into place where I want it to be and so on. And you can consistently keep to these habits for the rest of your life. And again, remembering it's not about being perfect or falling off a wagon or starting again, or, oh, I've just had a croissant for breakfast, so the rest of the day's stuffed. We just carry on, you know, from the next meal or snack. I love going out for a chocolate brownie, or if there's a really good chocolate croissant somewhere. And what I like is that I don't eat those things at home. So what's great about that is that you have the opportunity after you've eaten those things to walk. If you're out having your cake, you know, if you're not having these sorts of things at home where you'll probably just sit down afterwards, that's the beauty of it. Like, I don't mind when I go out on the weekend and I have a brownie, because we're going to leave that coffee shop and then go for a walk home, or walk somewhere, or, you know, park the car further away if you've driven there. But again, you know, that's not about becoming obsessive over these things. These are just small, simple tips. If you're not going to do that, you can't do that. Okay. You had a treat, move on. But if you can incorporate these things when you have these treats, great, even better. Okay, so you probably knew that I was going to bring sleep back into the conversation today, because it's really impossible not to. It's weaved into everything. One of the fascinating things that researchers have found is that even one poor night's sleep can temporarily reduce insulin sensitivity the following day. So we'll have this temporary day where our cells can be insulin sensitive, and that's just one night. I find this more empowering to know. It sort of reminds us that sleep isn't a luxury. It reminds us that sleep is one of the ways our body prepares itself to regulate energy well the next day. So if you've had a poor night's sleep and you're suddenly craving more sugary foods, it's not a sign that you've lost all your willpower overnight and you're failing, you're just not able to control yourself. It's another reminder that your physiology is always influencing your behaviors. And then once we understand that, we can meet ourselves where we are with a little more compassion, which is what I always say. So again, can you see what's happening here? We're not talking about one magic food, one super supplement, one perfect diet, one thing to cut out. We're talking about creating an internal environment for ourselves where our body can do what it was designed to do and work how it was designed to work. And that's why supporting blood sugar isn't about chasing perfect glucose graphs if we're tracking it. It's about supporting the whole body. And that's exactly the thread that's been running through every episode in this series since episode 93. So you might be wondering about continuous glucose monitors, GMs. You might have seen people wearing CGMs on their arm, on the side of their upper arm, even though they don't have diabetes. So originally these monitors were made for, I think even on the NHS now, I do think they're only still prescribed for people with diabetes or maybe pre-diabetic or obesity. But you might have seen people who you might think they don't have diabetes or they don't have a weight issue, that they're wearing them, because you can actually just buy them now online yourself. So whilst they can be useful in certain circumstances, I've used one twice before, just because if I'm going to talk to clients about them, I need to know how I experience it myself. I don't think most women need to become obsessed with tracking every tiny rise in blood sugar. It is fun. I thought it was quite fun to when I did it. But I'm not the sort of person that would become obsessed with tracking these sorts of things, but there are plenty of personalities that would. So I would always be very careful there, because, you know, we have to remember that our blood sugar is supposed to rise after meals. That's normal. The goal isn't to flatten every curve. It's to support healthy regulation over time, to make sure that your blood sugar can come back to a healthy range within an hour or two of eating a meal. That's the most important thing, not like more over and above how high it went after the meal. But it is very helpful. Personally, I'd rather women focus on building balanced meals, preserving, building muscle, sleeping well, managing stress, than becoming anxious about every glucose reading. I'll usually work with a client on those foundations first: balanced meals, supporting their sleep, supporting their nervous system, building muscle. And then after a while, if they would like to use a CGM, it can be really insightful just to see where we could make some more progress. We might just identify some meals that cause more of a spike than others. And then we can look at those meals and say, okay, well, that's possibly why, because of this, because of that. You know, I've had clients say, I do notice when I eat less than 30 grams of protein, for example, I get a higher spike. Or if I have a tablespoon more rice with that meal, I tend to get a higher spike, and so on. And that is just insightful information, but it shouldn't be anything that we become obsessed about.
So if there's one thing I'd love you to take away from today's episode, it's that blood sugar isn't just something that we think about when someone has diabetes or we're worried that we may be getting, you know, moving into that stage. It's one of the body's fundamental systems. It's so foundational. It influences your energy, your concentration, your mood, your focus, your cravings, brain fog, hormones, sleep, muscles, and also your long-term health every single minute of every single day. And the wonderful thing is that supporting your blood sugar doesn't require cutting out every carbohydrate. It doesn't require fearing food or going on a restrictive diet, chasing the latest nutrition trend on social media, of which there's loads. It comes back to the same simple foundations that we've been talking about throughout this series, that building balanced meals, eating enough protein, eating plenty of fiber, moving your body regularly, building and preserving muscle, new muscle, supporting your nervous system, prioritizing and supporting good sleep. So doing all of these things, these are the simple foundations that have a huge impact on your blood sugar and vice versa. So you can see how everything keeps coming back to these same foundational pillars. That these are the pillars that I work with every client and in Midlife Thrive: blood sugar, sleep, nervous system and stress, exercise that builds muscle and nourishes the body. They work as beautifully connected systems. And that's why I keep coming back to this idea of the whole body shift, which is what's happening in perimenopause. When we support one system, we almost end up always supporting the others. Better sleep will then usually lead to steadier blood sugar. Steadier blood sugar supports more stable energy. More stable energy makes it easier to move our bodies. Movement helps preserve muscle. Muscle improves insulin sensitivity. And suddenly we're creating a positive cycle rather than constantly feeling as though we're fighting an uphill battle. And I think that's such an encouraging message, because it reminds us that we don't have to do everything perfectly. We really just need to keep supporting our bodies in small, consistent ways over time. And like I say, it doesn't have to be 100% of the time, as long as for the most part, we are learning to build in these small supportive steps and we're being consistent as much as we possibly can, because those small choices all begin to add up and have that cascade effect together. So next week, we're going to move on to another really important piece of the puzzle. We're going to talk about muscle. So I've touched on it in this episode and last week, but we're going to dedicate a whole episode to it, not just simply as something that helps us to feel stronger or look lean and toned, but as one of the most powerful organs for healthy aging and health longevity, for metabolic health and for navigating perimenopause well and happily. So I can't wait to share that conversation with you next week. And as ever, take my free perimenopause quiz for some personalized guidance as to which of the foundational areas that we've talked about in all these episodes might be the biggest place for you to start right now. You can also join us inside Midlife Thrive. I'm opening up for, there's still spots for founding members at £10 a month for life instead of the regular price of £39 a month. So grab one of those places, drop me an email if you want one, or DM me on Instagram. And of course, for one-to-one support, you can find all that on my website. I'll also link to it in the show notes. See you next week. Bye-bye. If you enjoyed this episode and you're wanting a bit more support, there's a few ways I can help you. You can take my free perimenopause quiz, join my Midlife Thrive membership, or work with me one-to-one. And I'll leave all the details in the show notes. And if this episode resonated, I'd love you to share it with someone who might need to hear it too. Thank you so much for being here. It really means a lot. And I'll see you in the next episode.